you have had such a diverse and complex life and started out in Canada under very difficult circumstances at a very difficult time. How did you rise above racism? Because your degree of success by anyone's standards is amazing. But looking back to when you were born near Vancouver in 1936, just close to the beginning of the War Measures Act and the persecution of Japanese Canadians, how did you combat racism in your own world?
Well, thank you, Terry, for that question. It's true that when the Japanese were removed from the West Coast in 1942, it was basically because of racism towards our community, not only by British Columbians, but by their own government. And for me, that was a lesson. As I grew older, I recognized the fact that what happened to us likely should have never happened. And yet, it did happen. And so, as a result of that, our community began to question the action of the government at the time. And later on, our association, the National Association of Japanese Canadians, decided that as a result of what happened, that we pursue redress because we felt that our community was unfairly treated during the war. And so we pursued it, and finally in 1988, we were very fortunate that Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, sorry that he just passed away, was instrumental in recognizing that the rights of Japanese Canadians should have now happened, and in Parliament he acknowledged that mistake. And I'd like to just, if you don't mind, Terry, I'd like to just read parts of the book that relate to that section, because this is my tribute to our Prime Minister. I know in the last few days there's been many words being spoken by very prominent Canadians about the legacy, his contribution he made. But one of the things that I found personally when I met him is that he truly, I think, felt that what happened to a minority group needed to be recognized. I'd like to read just that very small portion when I personally met him just after the announcement in the House of Commons. Immediately after the orations, a member of the Prime Minister's office staff escorted me directly to the Prime Minister's office. Waiting alone to meet with the Prime Minister, I wondered, how should I greet him? Should I address him as Mr. Prime Minister or Honorable Brian Mulroney? While I was thinking about what to say, the Prime Minister walked into the room and came up to me and said, "Hello, Art," and then shook my hand. All that formal protocol that I was thinking vanished. I felt at ease with the Prime Minister and thanked him for his passionate words. As we walked downstairs to the room in which the official signing of the agreement would be taking place, I said to him, "It's taken a long time, but it was worth waiting for." His reply was, it's taken a long time for me to convince my colleagues that it was the right thing to do. I sensed sincerity and honesty in his response and genuine interest in resolving the redress issue. I think he wanted to do that much sooner, but his party members did not share the same view. It was an unbelievable feeling as we entered the small crowded room of cameras and reporters for the signing ceremony that was to symbolize the settlement. Members of our strategy team were present, along with Lucien Bouchard and Jerry Weiner, as the Prime Minister signed two sets of the same document in English and in French. The Prime Minister signed the first document and then handed it to for me to sign. Meanwhile, I could hear in the background with constant clicks from the cameras. Once the document was signed, we both stood. The Prime Minister turned to me and said, "May I just say to you and your leaders of the community who are here, some who are 86 and 87 years of age, who went through this personally, I say this as a moment of long coming of tolerance and for justice for your community and for Canada. I just want to do this for you. I just wanted to do this for you who have believed in the basic fairness of Canada." Mr. Mulroney began to clap. Everyone joined in. I replied, "I must say, Mr. Prime Minister, we were moved this morning by the comments that you made in the House of Commons. I know that today is a historic landmark, not only for our community, but for the human rights issue. Indeed, for me, the importance of redress settlement was not only what you did for the Japanese-Canadian community, but what you did in recognition of minority rights in Canada." And I truly believe that he was very sincere in his actions. And when I think back and reflect on the process that we went through, there was a lot of opposition within his own cabinet about doing this. And I know that the legal advisors to the Prime Minister's office, to the multiculturalism, kept saying, "Don't do this. You're going to set a precedent if you ever decide to do the redress for Japanese Canadians." So the advice within the government was really not to do it. But I think it was the Prime Minister in the end who took the bolts by the horn and he made it happen. So I really appreciate that. And that's my tribute to him too as well. Thank you.
When you were standing close to him, how did you figure out how to refer to him? Your Honor, Mr. Prime Minister?
I didn't have to worry. He made it for me. When he walked up and said, "Hello, Art," I knew that, well, what do you say? Hi. You just say, "Hi, Brian," and that was it.
You just said, "Hi, Brian"?
Yeah.
Now, the transition, though, to the point where the Prime Minister is speaking to you on a first-name basis is an incredible contrast to your arrival in Winnipeg as a, what, five-year-old, six-year-old?
Yes.
You came in, and the degree of separateness that your family was exposed to and the degree of persecution, there were times when you were forbidden to be in certain parts of the city, as I recall. When I read the book, some of the councillors didn't want Japanese in their neighborhoods. Why was that?
Well, there was such a negative reaction. I think it was basically because of what happened in Japan during the war with especially the Hong Kong vets, where they were tortured in concentration camps in Japan. And I think some of that reflected on our community, because when many people see you, they see you as Japanese, not as a Canadian. We were born in Canada, my parents were born in Canada, but we were never considered, we were never looked upon as someone who was born here. And because of the reaction initially of that, Japanese were very rare in Manitoba in 1942. And so many people had never seen an Asian before. When we were first moved here, we were put onto a sugar beet farm in St. Agathe, Manitoba, a French-Canadian community, and none of them had ever seen a Japanese, so they were curious about us.
What kind of reception did they offer to you?
Actually, they were very good to us. They helped us out. They were really good. Although everyone spoke French, and we didn't speak French, but we also were we were able to communicate with each other. And I do have pictures of some French-Canadian friends when we were young, so we must have talked to each other because we were all together.
When you moved into the city,
yes. Yes.
How did your experience with neighbors change?
Well, first of all, we moved into North Kildonan, and the reason I say that is because at that time, North Kildonan was not part of Winnipeg. It was separate from Winnipeg, and Japanese were not allowed to live in Winnipeg. So as a result, many of the people who moved towards Winnipeg would gravitate to areas that were outside the city limits, and so North Kildonan was that. There were a number of Japanese families who lived in North Kildonan, but you know, we were treated really well because the community is basically Mennonite. And I think their experience might in some ways equate to ours in terms of discrimination, because they really opened their arms to us. Many of us attended their churches and so on. And so as far as that's concerned, we were accepted in the community there. Although on the playground, sometimes there's a lot of negative things thrown at us. And I remember getting into a fight when I was in grade four and being strapped in the end for being in the fight because people are calling you names and you react. But I guess that's not what you do when you're young.
There was a point when you wanted to get to play hockey and to buy hockey gear. What did you do about getting the gear?
Oh, well, we lived in the central part of Winnipeg, around Logan Avenue and Salter. Many of the kids who lived in the area were pretty poor, and they didn't have hockey equipment. Many of them didn't have anything, proper equipment at all. So I was coaching the team and looking after it, and we decided that we would go out in the community and ask for donations so we could buy kids hockey sticks and so on. And while we were doing that, the Winnipeg Parks Board that looked after the rinks heard about it, and we got called over by them, and they said, you have to give the money back. You're not supposed to do that. And so a friend of mine and I actually went to City Hall, and we met with the mayor.
Stephen Juba, right?
Stephen Juba.
Yeah.
And we told him what happened. And in the end, he said to us, look, don't worry. Keep the money. I'll look after it. And that was it. But it was interesting, the bureaucracy, even at that time, we're trying to help kids, and yet the Parks Board felt that that wasn't the thing that we should be doing.
Did you have a noticeable time when racism began to fade or change?
Well, I think I encountered more racism during the time that we were negotiating with the government, especially because it was in the media law and I would get phone calls from people that I didn't know, or I'd be on a radio program doing an interview and there were some comments directed to me, especially referring to us that we should go back where we came from. And I was whenever I got that question, I sort of turned it around and said, well, I would like to try to go back where I came from, but I'm here. And then they said, well, what do you mean? Well, you have to explain to them that many of the people who were affected were born in Canada. So this is our country. So where do we go back to? And so it was that way of diffusing it. And I found that most people who didn't understand, after you talked to them for a while, they began to understand the issue. But that's one of the things that we made a point during negotiations is to really emphasize that we were Canadian citizens, because in the communities when people are negative towards you, it's because you don't look, they consider you an immigrant. I remember running as a candidate for a federal election, and one of the people...
What was it, East Kildonan?
Or Transcona.
Transcona, yes.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, one of the people said, I would never vote for that immigrant, and I was the only non-white person on the ballot. So obviously they're referring to me. But that was the perception that because we're visible, that you get from people. So they don't understand that we're here for five generations.
You began to counter racism in your own way by embracing Manitoba's diversity. You hung out for a while with Wab Kanu's father.
Well, actually, I attended the Truth and Reconciliation when they first started the meetings in Winnipeg, and he was on the panel that I was on, and when he mentioned that his son was Wab Kanu, well, and then now he's the premier, so yeah. That's and I'm sorry to say that Wab's father passed away a while back, but he was a great man, and he certainly in his life tried to gap understanding between the Indigenous and the other peoples.
And you worked to be more inclusive with not just people in Canada, but you went to South America and worked with people who were persecuted there as Japanese Bolivians, Japanese
Brazilians.
Brazilians, yes. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, when I first became involved with Redress, it was basically what we knew about Canada and the United States, because both are treated very similarly. Then I went to Peru, and I found out a whole different story there, that Japanese Peruvians, during the time of the war, were kidnapped by the American soldiers. They were kidnapped, taken to a place in Texas in the concentration camp, held there as hostages for trading for prisoner of wars with Japan. And so some of those people were sent to Japan in trade for prisoner of wars that were held in Americans who were held in Japan. So that kind of, and they were used for that. And I was quite shocked when I heard that. And they were saying that people were sitting in bars, and all of a sudden soldiers came in, rounded them up, put them on the boat, and they were gone. And the families never knew what happened to them.
You also went back to Japan to try to find people who were deserving of the redress that was organized in 1988.
Right.
They must have been a bit surprised with you in Japan then, looking for people to whom you wanted to give redress money.
Right. In fact, the Japanese media was quite intrigued by that, because when they heard that we were in Japan to give money that the Canadian government was looking to redress those people. And there were 4,000 people, by the way, who were sent to Japan from Canada. Half of them were Canadian citizens, but they were young at the time. And one of the options that the government tried to force on our community is go to Japan. Initially, they were going to send all of them to Japan, but when they realized that the majority were Canadians, it seems ludicrous to send someone outside the country. But there were 4,000 who went, and those people were eligible for redress. And our government sent a delegation there to look for them and sign them up. And I know that the media there were really intrigued about that, and we're being followed by their national television for about 3-4 days picking up on this story. And I remember meeting with one of the people in the Foreign Office, and he said, you know, Japan would never be able to do that, to acknowledge that they made a mistake, and they would go out and try to compensate people. And he said to me, you know, he said it takes a mature country to be able to do that. And I was really moved by his words, because Canada is a pretty young country. And yet when it comes to human rights, at least we're looked upon being mature. So that was something.
And
I think it's time.
Yeah, the last time I saw you was at the Human Rights Museum.
Right.
And there were a number of young Korean descent women there who were inviting you to join their K-pop band. They wanted you to help them to write songs. How's that going for you?
Well, to help organize, but that's okay.
And how's your work with K-pop doing?
Yeah? Well, no, they're doing fine. It's just that I don't think I could handle it, though.
Looking at the span of your life, well, speaking on your behalf, you could easily handle it.
Oh, okay.
Art, thank you very much for your time today.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.